KSDP 830 AM, Sandpoint, Alaska, and K201DA 88.1 FM, King Cove.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlap. Public canoe cabins are very popular in Alaska, with most being reserved months in advance. Various organizations are working on new huts, and on this Outdoor Explorer, we highlight two, Arta Valley Ski Area and Alaska Huts. General Manager John Robinson and architect Alana Blau describe the challenges of building cabins in Arctic Valley's alpine environment. On the second half of the show, Alaska Huts Executive Director Philip Sweeney updates us on their new hut at the Spencer Glacier Whistle Stop. Stay tuned for Outdoor Sport.
Hi, this is Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Build a rewarding career. IBEW offers top-notch training programs that set you on the path to success. IBEW jobs come with strong wages and benefits, ensuring your family's financial security. At the end of your career, you'll have a healthy pension thanks to IBEW's commitment to ensuring you have a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. On this episode, we're talking about what's new with huts and cabins in South Central Alaska. I have John Robinson Wilson, the General Manager of Arctic Valley Ski Area, and Alana Blow, an architectural designer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Lots happening up in Arctic Valley. It's been so impressive to watch that place grow and change. So, John, why don't you sort of talk to us about the huts up there and, you know, the history of that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So just to start a little broader, Arctic Valley, we're a membership-owned nonprofit ski area just above Anchorage in the Chugach Mountains there. And, you know, the ski area has got a long history. You know, it was first started as a military recreation facility in the 1940s during World War II, and the ski area civilian side, which is, you know, what we turned into, separated in the 1950s and moved up valley a little bit. But, you know, the Anchorage Ski Club goes back even further to, you know, I think it was 1937 was when it was founded, you know, and first operated a rope tow that down serviced a hill downtown off the side of Ship Creek down there.
Yeah,
so
so
we, you know, we've been around for a long time, and the, you know, a lot of that, you know, success and that you were so kind to mention, you know, stems from our efforts over the last, you know, 20 years to diversify our income a lot and turning in from just a ski area into more year-round, generate more year-round revenue, less revenue that's dependent on how much snow falls each week and how many skiers that we get up there. So, and they building these public use cabins has definitely been a boost and helped us in that.
Yeah, I know at one point there was sort of a moment, existential moment a while back with Arctic Valley, and there was like, and you came out, you got tubing, and you got weddings, and you got all kinds of stuff, and then the cabins.
Yeah, yeah, and that was when I first got involved, was in 2009. You know, we had a big meeting over at the Kincaid Chalet, and they kind of determined, were you there?
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, you know, and kind of determined if there was enough support, you know, to continue on, and a group of us, you know, stepped up, and some folks that were already on board recommitted, and, you know, we've... yeah, had a lot of pretty good success, you know, since then. And yeah, been able to diversify our revenue a lot, which has allowed us to make improvements and offer more services and grow our staff, which, you know, helps with reliability and consistency and that sort of thing, which, you know, in turn helps make the ski area and everything else, you know, more attractive for people to come and recreate.
One of those pieces is the cabins. We'll talk about the, I think there was one, the Chair 2 cabin?
Yeah, so we started, it was actually almost kind of incidental. We there's a ski patrol duty station at the top of Chair 2. So we always, when that lift is open, we always have to have a ski patroller on duty up there. And that building was in terrible, terrible disrepair, had mold and was literally falling apart. And so we knew we needed to rebuild it. So it started as just a, you know, kind of bare bones rebuild project in, I think it was in summer of 2020. And just as we were getting started, that one of our board members actually said, you know, this would be a really cool place for a public use cabin. And Alana and Adam stepped up and kind of took that challenge and, you know, redesigned the building basically on the fly to serve as a beautiful public use cabin with a great, you know, view looking out over Anchorage. We've had it open in the summers ever since August 2020, I think, is when we opened it. And it's been, you know, great success, full almost every night that we have it open, you know, and it's not a small thing to get up there. You know, it's a climbing to the top of Chair 2 in the summer is, you know, it's over 1,000 vertical feet, you know, a mile and a half or so. So not super long, but definitely a challenging, you know, bit of a challenging hike, especially with gear for an overnight. You know, I've seen lots of families with, you know, carrying water and a couple of kids in packs. Yeah. So, you know, it's really cool to see how much folks have embraced it and what a success that's been.
It's at the sort of at the top of the chair.
Yep.
And some people walk up there. And what's in the cabin? What amenities are there?
So we've got two queen size bunk beds. So sleeps four people, and electric stove and power, and a incinerator toilet is up there, along with a microwave and electric heat as well.
And a great view.
You know, and a lot, and those, you know, and just that stuff is, you know, amenities that you're not going to find at a traditional public use cabin, right?
Yeah. So a lot of talk about that hut and the design and design challenges of basically taking an old, falling apart building, it sounds like, and into something that's usable and rentable.
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge fitting into the tight existing footprint under the lift shack and the offloading ramp. So we had to negotiate existing posts coming down into the ground that are supporting the ramp and the lift shack and incorporate that into the layout. The original structure, it didn't even have the proper joist underneath it. Oh, it was spanned between 8 feet between two trusses. And so when we were demoing it, it was like interesting to demo it because you don't have any joists to walk on. So you're just demoing the layers of, and so, I mean, that was just some of the interesting construction of this, you know, back in the day when they were just made it work kind of under that lift for that ski patrol observation room. Basically, in order to fit the beds in, we had to push through back into the towards the mountain the footprint of the original structure, but it was still very tight. And then there's a transformer and other electrical services that we had to negotiate, but because we had electrical, we could take advantage of that. So there were some interesting challenges, but then it also allowed us to do interesting solutions because of the electrical access that we had. So we were able to then use an incinerator toilet as our toilet access, since it was on top of a mountain and it's very rocky ground. You can't really put an outhouse very easily there and service the outhouse. So that was a solution that came about for that. And then because we had electricity as well, we could just use electric heat. So that was another convenient aspect. However, there were definitely the challenges of it being on top of the mountain, windy, the weather, wind considerations for the windows.
You know, we get some 100-mile-an-hour windstorms at the top of Chair 2 every year. So, you know, as they were negotiating all this other stuff, you know, I think I was kind of a little bug in their ears, like, hey, remember, we got to... Yeah, you know, I mean, I remember having discussions about the size of the windows and, like, are these going to be okay, you know, when we get our annual 120-mile-an-hour windstorm up here?
Yeah, and the rocks that fly up. and hit the window.
Oh, really? Wow.
So.
Yeah, when it blows that hard, it tends, you know, these are usually winter storms, and it tends to strip the snow away along the top of the mountain. And then once the snow is gone, it'll actually pick up small rocks and fling them at things.
Yeah, those are little missiles.
Yeah, there's a weather station up at the top of the mountain above the public use cabin that's maintained by the Friends of the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And that's every 2 or 3 years, we get a big enough windstorm that it picks up those rocks and throws it through the anemometer cups and actually breaks the anemometer up there. And so we have to go up and replace it.
Those things are off the ground a ways.
Those kinds of considerations were not a small thing, you know, as Lana was going through and trying to figure out how this thing's going to work for us.
Another challenge was the multi-use of the structure. It's such a small structure, but in the winter and during operation season, it's used by ski patrol. And then it's transformed into a public use cabin the rest of the year. So, you know, as a designer, you have to consider that multi-use and the wear and tear and basically having everyone have what they need storage-wise, how it's going to be transformed, and what type of maintenance it's going to have to it. And so those were all considerations that we definitely had to work through.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want your sleepers taking naps up there getting too comfortable.
Yeah.
So that was a success. And then on to the new hut.
Yeah, so we've got a life member of Anchorage Ski Club, life member John Fowler, who really loves the cabins, you know, these public use cabins. And so a couple of years ago, he started pushing hard for us to think about what that next one was going to be. I don't remember if it was just him or if you had helped, but Alana, but, you know, we identified that site. It's called the Getz Public Use Cabin, is in our lower parking lot over across the road from the lodge. And there's actually a bench that goes around the back side, kind of the back side of the ridge back there. I think I assume when they were building that in the 50s or whatever, the guy who was driving the bulldozer just got like a kind of a wild hair and just kind of kept going, because there's really no reason.
Been known to happen, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's really no reason for that bench to exist back there.
But to our advantage.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, it worked beautifully for sure. But yeah, I was surprised that it was there, honestly. But it's, you know, being around that backside, you're not far from the parking lot, maybe a couple of hundred feet, but seems very private. You look out over the bottom of Cherwan and, you know, that kind of south side of Arctic Valley, and then up into Ship Creek Valley there as well. Yeah, so John Fowler really helped, you know, push us along, and we did a bunch of fundraising. Him and his family donated a bunch of money to help us build it. We did a fundraiser, and a bunch of other ski club members and members of the public donated as well. And so, you know, most of the money for that new cabin was donated. Oh, yeah, and we just opened it last fall in November, I believe. Has been a huge success so far.
Yeah. So a lot of talk a bit about designing and building it.
It was a different process than Chair 2 because Chair 2 was an existing structure that we were replacing. And then right after that, Arctic Valley and Anchorage Ski Club got the concession agreement with State Parks renewed. So we had a public process then in this case that was a little bit more involved with State Parks. And also planning with the Anchorage Ski Club Board of Directors and the planning committee that was formed to do a master plan and strategic plan and all of that. So there was a lot more public process, and that was very interesting to navigate, but everybody worked together and everyone was very excited about it. So that we used that energy and we just kind of worked through all of the challenges or the questions, design questions that came up during the process. And the cabin, it was another challenging site in the sense that because of the location, the proximity to the parking lot, the board of directors and we all, you know, all of the in the planning committee wanted to take advantage of that to make it an accessible cabin. because of that and the narrowness of the bench, we wanted to maximize the amount of capacity for sleeping beds, but then also provide as many sleeping beds that were also accessible. And then the whole cabin had to be accessible with the clearances for wheelchair accessibility. And so that was an interesting try to maximize that capacity, minimize the cost of the building, so the size, and then it's always that play in design that you do. So that was one of the challenges that we overcame. And then also wanted to maximize the views and kind of fit it into the site. And then again, it's still having that challenging climate with the location of high wind. So we worked with a structural engineer about the wind uplift and the structure, dialing that in. And then also when I was designing the structure, I was considering wind drifting and all of that. It is above tree line, Arctic Valley, and we didn't have electric access over there like we did Chair 2. We did luckily already have an existing outhouse to use that's only 400 feet by the parking lot there. So we were going to utilize that for the toilet access. However, we didn't have electricity for heat. So there was a design question of how are we going to heat this building? Is it going to be a wood stove? Is it going to be a propane stove? And that was definitely something to work through, where we didn't want people taking all the alders that, you know, there's hardly any alders there, and or providing wood, you know, that would be a lot of maintenance. So then, you know, the cost of propane, is that going to go into the cost of the public use cabin itself and be covered? So that was another question that we had to figure out. And we ended up going with propane because it is an all year round cabin. It's going to be very convenient, and already is now that it's been open, to just have it like preheated when you go in after skiing. People lean towards a propane stove because of that. It seems to be working good with the maintenance and all of that.
You know, just being able to provide that and have that cabin be 50 degrees when you walk in, you know, and not
that's
have it
nice.
Be.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, you know, and not having it be, you know, 0 degrees or whatever, and then having to build a fire to warm it up. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the big things that we were happy to be able to offer.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. We are talking about cabins and huts in South Central. John Robinson Wilson with Arctic Valley, and Alana Bloom, an architect that helped design the new huts up there. So got propane, and it's a beautiful hut. I mean, I really was impressed with the sort of design of it. So sort of describe the design to people, like give them a little visual of what it looks like.
Yeah, the cabin features. So first, we wanted to capture those views. So we included large picture windows to capture the beautiful views of Ship Creek Valley and Arctic Valley ski area on the other side. And then we also made that windows operable as well. Because it is not electric, we couldn't provide mechanical ventilation. Mm-hmm. And so then in the summer, obviously might heat up with all the solar gain and the beautiful windows. So we provided cross ventilation with the operable windows account for that.
Sorry, that was the I've driven up Arctic Valley Road a lot of times at this point. That was my most nerve-wracking drive up the road.
Was
ringing those windows up the road, you know, just crawling along. And, you know, as Arctic Valley Road unfortunately gets a little washboardy in the summer.
Oh, boy, I bet, yeah.
And, yeah, that was my slowest and most nerve-wracking drive by a long shot bringing those things up there.
So the thing I really like about the cabins at Arctic Valley is they're custom to the site, but not only to the site, to Arctic Valley and the members, because it was a member process we were so intricately involved. A bunch of volunteers built the cabins, both of them, and they're building the two new ones as well. That gives it this really custom, unique touch. Like, for instance, Bruce Rain, he made custom coat racks out of old ski parts.
And
he did that for the Chair 2 cabin as well. And so we had him do that for the Getz cabin. And then one of the design features was we wanted to have the cabin have a unique look to it, but also fit it into the bench site where there was a slope behind it, and kind of accent that. And so we came up with a canted wall in the back that's a 14-degree angle. It kind of reflects the angle of the slope behind it and makes the cabin look part of the slope. And then on the inside, instead of making a straight wall on the inside and wasting that space, we just captured it. We put pine wood planks up the canted wall and then on the inside of the ceiling there. That 14-degree angle is perfect for lounging behind the beds.
Uh-huh.
And I made the design layout so that all the beds are leaning up against that. You can just sit on the bed and look out at the view and lean back, and it's so comfortable. I actually have stayed there myself, just hung out there when other friends have the cabin, and I don't want to leave. I sit on the bed and I'm like, I don't want to get up. This is so great. That little feature just made the cabin have a unique look to it. Other volunteers made concrete countertops and a concrete hearth for the propane stove. Just very detail-oriented, the volunteers made these pieces. Like the hearth has a Arctic Valley little emblem embedded into it.
Wow.
Huh. And so that's really fun. And then there's a fire pit adjacent to the cabin, and there's a large covered, it's a partially covered, partially sun deck that wraps around the cabin. And we also use because of the donations that we got, and we're very grateful for, as a designer, I was able to use very good materials, which always makes me very happy. Cedar lap siding and cedar plank boards for under the roof and the soffit. That's just really great. Beautiful materials just makes a beautiful piece.
Yeah, we think a lot about outdoors, but having a piece of a building like this that fits into the landscape is really awesome.
Yeah. And just to back up a little bit, it's named the John and Janet Getz Cabin. They were some of the really instrumental Anchorage Ski Club members in separating the our operations, the civilian side operations, from the military operations in the 1950s. And so John really, I think, spearheaded the move kind of up the valley a little ways to where we are now. And Janet was actually in charge of splicing the old rope toes every year that ran up the mountain. So we are excited to name it. In general, we recognize that we don't do enough recognition of kind of the historical volunteers and the people who built Arctic Valley. And so this was our first shot at trying to do more of that. So
I'm sort of curious about people can get on the website and reserve it.
So it's a rolling 6-month reservation, just like most of them are. You can make reservations on our website at arcticvalley.org. Both that cabin and the Chair 2 cabin are under the summer menu on the website. And you can go on there and make your reservations. They are both $150 a night. The Chair 2 cabin is only open, is going to be open June 1st through the end of September this year. And the Getz cabin is open year round.
And I heard new cabins. More?
Yeah. So we are just starting to build two additional cabins. They're going to be kind of right at the end of that parking lot, closer to the outhouses there, funded by Municipality of Anchorage ARPA grant. They're going to be smaller. I think it's going to be four each, right?
Yeah. And there's a little loft. So there's a double bed downstairs and then two single, mattresses up at a loft.
Yep. Those are getting started now and then will hopefully be finished this fall. And same kind of process, Alana's leading the design and we've got a great group of volunteers that are, working on doing the construction for us.
Yeah, and I think they're probably pretty popular.
Yeah, the Getz cabin has been sold out pretty much all spring here. I believe, I haven't looked in a little bit, but I believe there's still a few days left in April and then some more over the summer here. So yeah, there's lots of, they've been very popular, and we think, as word gets around about them more that, they'll fill up faster and faster.
Yeah, the amazing thing about that cabin, too, is you can go up there and berry pick right out of the cabin.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're lucky enough to get it. So
yep. That's Yeah, and you know, like I said, they've just gotten more popular, you know, as the years have gone by. And so we think, looking forward to, you know, having people staying up there, you know, all summer with us. I think it's, they're going to be really surprised at how nice and, you know, look, reading through the guest comments in the guest book so far, people are, you know, really grateful for this kind of close to town, relatively easy to access, you know, real, but it's a real escape to, you know, go up there and just be looking out at the mountains and not have any neighbors or anything like that.
Some people have been calling the Chair 2 cabin the Anchorage penthouse because it's so nice and has a great view over.
Yeah,
you can actually have pretty good internet access over there, so you can remotely work up there as well.
Yeah, outside of the mountain club huts, it's probably one of the highest ones you can get to.
Yeah, it's
and pretty accessible.
Yeah, it's about 4,000 feet up there. So
yeah. As an organization, it seems like it's working out for you. Any challenges or any things that you see in the future that are going to be a challenge?
These ones are relatively easy kind of logistically for us. They're close, you know, to our base areas, so it makes kind of keeping tabs on them and easy. We're close to existing restrooms, which is a huge thing for us. You know, we, in our master plan, which you can find on our website, we identified some other areas that are, we think, have a lot of potential for public use cabins. Those are much further afield. You know, there's some that are over by the kind of on the south corner by the new Marston Trail.
Yeah.
Over there, those would come with a lot more kind of logistical difficulties, both in building and maintenance and that sort of thing, because there's much less existing infrastructure over there, and they're a little further away. But, you know, that's a little ways down the road. You know, we're focused on getting these next two done this summer, and then we'll, you know, start exploring and see what the possibilities
are
and
what
will work out there.
Yeah. Well, thank you both very much for joining me, and good luck. Sounds like a great endeavor.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage.
To Leadership Circle visionaries Cammie and Scott Taylor, your support keeps Alaska Public Media going strong. Thank you for making a difference in our community.
Accessible, affordable, and high-quality childcare shapes Alaska's future. THREAD, Alaska's Child Care Resource and Referral Organization, thanks early childhood educators for their dedication to Alaskan families. Happy Provider Appreciation Day. This message sponsored by THREAD.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from donors like you and from Alaska Air Transit, flying Alaskan families, essential workforce, and cargo to communities statewide, specializing in on-demand charters. There's more at flyaat.com. Baker & Associates, 8th Avenue, specializing in sustainable fine furniture and home design for Alaskan interiors, kitchens, and baths since 1982. Baker & Associates, your home for life.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer's episode on cabin and huts in South Central Alaska. With me on Zoom is Philip Swinney, Executive Director of Alaska Huts. Thanks for joining us today, Philip.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you, Paul.
So Alaska Huts, boy, it's been quite a project. And tell us a little bit about Huts and what you guys are up to.
Certainly. Originally, we've been around for about 20 years, 21 now, was originally founded. And the piece that most people are probably familiar with related to Alaska Huts is the Manitoba cabin and yurts down along the Seward Highway. That was our first foray into lodging. The organization's real focus, the mission, we could say, is to build and maintain backcountry lodging that promote camaraderie, stewardship, outdoor education, and, you know, Alaska's cultural heritage. And so we provide a relatively simple lodging options that are quite easily accessible and provide a lot of the amenities that other huts, cabins, yurts don't necessarily have. So that's what we've been doing. And I think the topic we may be foraying into this afternoon or today is talking about the new hut being built out near Spencer Glacier.
And you already have one hut, right?
Correct. It's a 1930s mining cabin originally. It's gone through various different forms of life over that, 90 plus years. And that is the core of our, and I could use the word campus, kind of a grandiose term, but and then there are three yurts, satellite yurts, which are utilized around that. This is at Manitoba, a property down near Seward Highway.
Yeah, and that's just a short ski in, right?
It's half a mile or so, depending on what snow's like. Yes, yep.
And it's available year-round?
Correct. If you visit our website, you can book online. Reservations are needed and are very popular. it's been interesting to see the growth in that. We can sleep up to about 25 people there in between the room in the historic cabin and those three yurts.
I'd also note that Alaska Huts is a lot of volunteers, right? I know you have a wood chopping event down there. You're always looking for people to help out.
We are very much, it's a membership-based organization. We really rely on the community and we're very involved with. We do have two weekend events per year where, and always looking for more volunteers who feel like coming out and helping. We call it sort of a wood stock, and that is because we are resupplying our wood supplies for the year. So we do it twice a year, once in the spring, once in the fall, we end up moving quite a bit of wood, as well as various other housekeeping, maintenance, all those fun things. And then we just try to bring people together as well. So it's a great, get some work done, spend some time with friends and meet some new potential friends, et cetera. So
nice. Let's talk about the Spencer Hut, or I think it's technically the Lars Sprickler Memorial Hut.
Correct.
What's the history behind it?
So that actually was one of the original driving forces of this organization. Actually predates the Manitoba property. That was the cause around which the organization Alaska Huts was founded. And it has, as a result, it's been a little while in the making, we are getting really, really close. It's very exciting. It's been a huge amount of work. It's a partnership between ourselves, Alaska Huts Association, the Forest Service, and the Alaska Railroad. And so we're working with the railroad and, of course, the Forest Service, whose land that the administrator is. And it is a location which has been discussed for a long time, but has not really had a lodging facility. There's the campground, there's the Spencer Bench Hut. This would be down in the flats, much closer to the whistle stop, I'd say half a mile, a little bit more from the glacier face and the pond there itself.
So for people, listeners who aren't familiar with the area, the whistle stop is a train ride, right? You get on at either Anchorage or Portage, and I don't know, you take a train to it, right? More or less.
Correct. That's part of what is so unique, especially I would say in North America, is in Europe, not that I've experienced, but I've seen and read about a lot of train connected or train access to outdoor recreation, huts included in that. This would be a train ride, as you said, leaving from Anchorage, from Portage, even closer, or could be Seward. And there are several different trains during the passenger season, running from mid-May until mid-September, which stop at that location or travel through that location. So if anybody's ever ridden the train down to Seward, et cetera, they have passed right through the whistle stop, the Spencer whistle stop there. The Forest Service has a certain amount of infrastructure there, this would be an addition to that, and trail access and beautiful walking trails and all those right in that area.
Yeah, and then the Spencer Glacier is right there. It's a big cabin glacier and old lake. And I believe there's another outfitter that does like kayaking and ice climbing and stuff like that also.
Correct. There are several different outfitters operating in that area and other tour-related groups. So, yes, it's there's a reason why there's activity there. It's absolutely spectacular location.
Yeah, yeah. And now you're in the process of building it. Is that right? And that's been quite the effort.
Building in Alaska is always a bit of an adventure, but once you get a little bit more remote, it's even more of an adventure. So yes, just getting materials up. We have the structure is actually a prefabricated hut from a company which manufactures specifically for, not necessarily for remote locations, but for speedy assembly. We were trying to minimize impact on the user public and outfitters, et cetera, who operate in the area. So we went with a hut structure, which was fully assembled in a third location, imported into Alaska, and then we could take it out there, basically palletized, and assemble the hut. It's super insulated and quite modern in the design with metal siding and roofing, so it should be pretty impervious to the relatively challenging weather, which is the norm out in that area, as I'm sure many people know. So a design for that, but also designed for the aesthetic eye and to blend into the environment and also to take advantage of views, etc., in the area.
How big?
We will be of a capacity around 13 people per night would be the max. The square footage, it's sort of in the low thousands, but really the that sort of is immaterial compared to the number of people. So we'll have a capacity of about 13 people per night.
Will there be a caretaker there, or what's the plan with that?
This is not becoming a lodge by any stretch. Anybody who stayed down at Manitoba, they're familiar with. It's certainly not a camping, but it's also by no stretch is this a lodge experience. Pretty simple. And so we will have staff, volunteer support out there at times, but this is not going to be, you know, show up and turn down service with mint on the pillow and a 5-course meal being, you know, delivered by people. This is much more in line with Manitoba and other hut experiences around the state, but it's really a place to bring people together, to get people outside, where the barrier of entry is reduced or minimized. It's not a multi-hour trek up a steep incline. This should be relatively fully accessible along good trails with access whenever the train is running, and then in the wintertime once snow fills in via whatever means of transport you want to use, snow machine, fat bike, skis, to access in the winter. So
we'll be available in the winter.
Correct. Yes. I think, you know, we certainly see the winter as a time when outdoor recreation in Alaska is very one of the prime seasons. And so, yes, once the Placer Valley is open for overland access, then yes. But we'll be working very closely with the Forest Service and, of course, the railroad on this for access year round.
Give us a picture of the hut, like what it looks like. Are there bedrooms? Or is there, I assume there's a kitchen, windows?
Sure. Yeah, wonderful question. Apologies. We'll certainly have some photos up soon. It is a two-story structure, narrow and quite long, again, to work with high snow loads. I think last season there was over 10 feet of snow sitting on the ground out there, not this past winter, but the prior winter. And so we're dealing with high snow loads. And of course there's the component of seismic activity. So we've worked along those lines to really build the structure to be resilient and durable in all those. Large glass windows on the south end. So very unobstructed views down onto the Placer Valley or, you know, to the south along the Placer Valley. This first floor will be a general sort of living area. I think kitchen would be not necessarily the term that I would use, but a cooking space and for dishes and a communal space. And then upstairs, there will be two rooms, separate rooms up there for sleeping.
But sounds like pretty bare bones.
We will provide a certain amount of amenities, but it's not, by no stretch is this a lodge. You will be bringing your own wood for heating, cooking fuel for that. It is a structure to enable people to spend time out in a absolutely spectacular remote location, but it is by no stretch or by no means is going to be a linen tablecloth
technique. Right. We're so used to that in Alaska.
Exactly. I think this would be much like many public use cabins around the state, but just perhaps a little bit more infrastructure there, but certainly not exorbitantly so.
Right. What about like when I reserve it, or let's say when it's open, we'll talk about that in a minute. Will it be just my group, or can multiple groups reserve it? How does that work?
That's a wonderful question, and we're figuring that out, and also that's an ongoing set of discussions with the Forest Service, exactly how this will be happening. But there will be a couple of different options. There will be an option to rent the whole structure, and then that will be a sort of an earlier option, and then a little bit later in the season, or as time approaches, it would be the option to rent by the room. So that would be basically two different rooms or the whole structure. For anybody who's been to our Manitoba property, it's certainly part of the joy is meeting other people who are down there. And I'd say 99.9% of the time, people are down there with a similar set of interests, et cetera. And so the number of times that I've heard from people is like, we made friends down here 20 years ago. Not quite 20 years ago, many years ago. But and as a result, we've been coming down here every year since, or something along those lines, friendships, relationships, family groups meeting, and all those kind of things. So it's really as part of our mission is to bring people together outside and to really build that community aspect. So trying to build in the multifaceted nature of that.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. With me today, we have Philip Swindy, the executive director of Alaska Huts, talking about the new hut at Spencer Glacier. So let's talk about, been a challenge building it, I think, because you got to get everything in there by rail, and the railroad doesn't necessarily operate in the winter out there. So where are we at with opening, and how's that looking?
That's a wonderful question. As I have found from doing this in the past, not necessarily solely in Alaska, but in other places around the country, timelines love to look wonderful on paper. And then once the reality of fieldwork starts, it often pushes back a little bit. I would say that we're planning to open this year in 2025. The exact timeline, I'm not going to give that answer right now, but I'd like to think that later this summer we'll have be soft opening, that kind of thing, moving towards getting people in there and doing the finishing touches, et cetera. But I'd say 2025 with pretty high confidence. Again, it's just access, getting materials and those kind of things is always a little bit of a challenge. But I've been saying with pretty good confidence we're in the high 90s% for completion, but I just want to make sure that we're really at that 100% before we get things rolling.
Yeah. What's really got you and your volunteers and your board excited about this new project?
I think the piece which is really exciting is just adding more to the infrastructure of huts in Alaska. People, it's common in Europe. Again, there's a very elaborate, robust structure, slightly different from what we provide. Again, more of the full table service. You can get food, beverages, etc. In Alaska, the demand we've seen increase dramatically in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, huge increases for ourselves and from everybody else I've talked to. And just the fact that there are quite a few more of these structures in various different forms, yurts, huts, simple, complex, opening up around the state. So the demand is there, and the interest is there. And our membership, our board, have been so enthusiastic about this location because of people's familiarity with the Placer River Valley and Spencer Glacier area. Again, incorporating the railroad into that is really a unique experience. If anybody's ridden the train in the summer, the number of people from out of the state of Alaska coming through, looking at the natural wonders that we have is huge. And so really it's bringing together people together in a place which, in a simple way, in a way that emphasizes the natural beauty and interacting with nature, because it is quite unconnected. There is no cell phone service out in the area at all. So it will greatly encourage people to spend time with each other and spend time outside in an absolutely beautiful location. So really continuing to add to that has really been the driving force, I'd say, behind our organization for sure.
With all that beauty comes risk. Does your organization worry about putting people out there in an environment that is remote, specifically no communication, very little communication?
Of course. I mean, I think common sense and or risk management on that approach, but it's not like people aren't already out there. There's a very robust campground already out at Spencer Glacier. There's already the Spencer Bench Hut up on the bench above the glacier. There are a lot of people going out there every day. I mean, as I just mentioned, when I go out there in the summer or when I ride the train out there, there are 100 plus people who are walking out and around in that area. And this will be certainly relayed to our guests, and I would encourage anybody who's getting outside is be prepared.
So risk management, people out there in remote Alaska, doesn't sound terribly remote, but I've been out there and seen people like with rubber duckies on that lake, which is a cold lake. I mean, it's glacier water. And I had a wonderful time going out there in the train and pack rafting back to the highway. So there's a lot of great adventures to be had out there. You got this project, and hopefully it'll be open here in 2025 some point. What's next for Huts?
This is what we're focusing on right now. I really like to, if we take on a project, I like to do it well. And so we'll be finishing this up, but certainly got our eyes to the future. Part of what we as an organization, our goal to do is a set of interconnected huts in the state of Alaska. So always looking, always having those conversations, really love having those conversations. It's a wonderful excuse to get away from behind a computer and out into the field and take a look at spectacular sights or ideas that people have. And so we are interested in that and moving forward into the future. And just on a quick note, you mentioned the lake. I was out at the lake one day. I think everybody was heading back to the train and I was just standing there quietly. And all of a sudden, one of the large chunks of ice started moving and then the whole thing rolled over. And watching, you know, that sort of the take of having 25% or less above the surface and the rest below, watching that chunk of ice roll in what I thought was very shallow water gave me even more of an appreciation for the depth and size of that glacial lake right at the mouth of Spencer. So a wonderful area.
Yeah, and I just realized that, I mean, yeah, you talk about a lot of people out there, but they all pretty much leave, right? Like, you know, if you're going to have this hut, you'll be out there. There'll be other people camping maybe, but you'll sort of have the place to yourself.
That is one of the most magical experiences I've had is, you know, train, you go out, there's lots of people walking in and around. And then once that train departs, you feel very remote and it is really quiet. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that, Paul. That is truly, it is a spectacular silence that you get or just the sounds of nature and not really any people. And there are a couple of trains which go by a day, but really, even though you are along a railroad line and close to one of the larger highways in the state, you are in a remote location for sure.
Thanks, Philip. We've had Philip Sweeney with Alaska Huts. Thanks for joining us today, Philip.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks very much, Paul.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from Alaska Public Media. I'm the show's producer, Tobin Shelby. To wrap up this week's episode, we're going to listen back to a portion of Paul Twardock's conversation with outdoor safety instructors Debbie Yongo and Luke Mell about risk tolerance, something that came up in this week's episode, and how it affects decision-making in outdoor adventuring. This interview first aired in October of 2024. You can find complete episodes of Outdoor Explorer at alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Talk about physical risks, but there's obviously, earlier on you mentioned emotional too. So talk about that a bit.
The physical risk, of course, would be like the significant injury and fatality. And we all know that. We theoretically know that somebody could die. But we tend to, that's where you can call it kind of a risk homeostasis where we don't really think it's going to happen because we can compensate for it, right? We'll get better. We'll wear seatbelts. We'll have airbags, whatever it is. But we compensate, so we believe that we're suppressing this probability. And we are, actually. We are making it less probable. But whether some people are very unfortunate and the fatality happens in the first week, some people, like you said, you get to do it for a long time before you see the fatality. But once that fatality happens, that is just so emotionally, I think, kind of mind-blowing. Like, Luke, you can tell me what you thought, but most people, what they say is, I never imagined that that's what it was going to be like. I didn't expect it to be so significant for me. Would you agree?
Yeah. I was totally unprepared for how much that influenced not just my outdoor recreation life, but just everything.
Yeah, I have truly spoken to certainly more than 100 people around the planet. And that's a very common saying that I hear. And that for me, I feel like as an industry, like we got to address this, like, because people don't know what to do with those emotions then. And a lot of people walk away from the outdoors. And what I have found is the people who stay tend to become really good risk managers. Not all of them. Some of them probably should have left the industry. But the people who stay are so, like, they get it. They are now really nuanced in how they manage risk. Luke?
Yeah, this is a good... So I'll talk a little bit about what I did after those crashes, both for the water worlds and the snow worlds, and that, because my response was totally different, and I wasn't aware of any of this when it happened, but just looking back 15 years or whatever, in the snow sports, I just turned my back to it. That's like, this is a stressor. This is a hot stove. Like, how many times do you want to get burned before you stop touching the stove? And so it was just avoidance. And I think part of that's healthy, but I think part of it's unhealthy. It's like people talk about like an irrational fear. Is that the right term? Yeah. But then in paddle sports, for whatever reason, on that one, I doubled down and I sought out mentors and I got formal training and I started over. I started over with my own skill progression and my preparedness, both for anticipating what can go wrong and then responding when things do. And that put me in a position now where I teach that stuff. And I think it's fair to say, like, I'm very capable at both managing that risk and responding when stuff goes wrong. But I'm still freaked out in avalanche terrain. And it's fascinating to me, my own brain. And I'll talk with friends, you know, that are guides, winter guides, and they're like, I can't believe you do that water stuff. It's like, it's so risky. And I'm like, I can't believe you're skiing avalanche slopes, because I feel like that's a problem I can't solve. And for whatever reason in the water, I feel like it's a problem I can solve.
And to me, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make sense why you have categorized one over the other, but it totally makes sense that it's about your sense of control and competence, right? And benefit, right? It's the gamble. So for you, the benefit that you were getting from the snow sports did not overwhelm the risk that you were taking, right? It's like, nope, I can't control this. There's not good enough benefit. I'm going to leave this one behind. But you must get tremendous benefit out of the water, and you have tremendous capabilities and competence that you can manage those risks enough that it's worth it for you, right?
Yeah, I love that. That's a great insight that I've never had. Yeah.
I wrote down, you mentioned risk homeostasis. You want to talk about that a little bit, Deb?
Yeah, so risk homeostasis is, if you think of like a car, right? Most people, we can use this analogy, most people can follow, is nobody wants to die in a car accident. So some people will drive very, very carefully. And then the more faster we drive, the curvier it is. Generally, if you had no protections whatsoever, no seatbelt, no airbags, no nothing, you would start to get more and more fearful, right? So I'm less tolerant of these risks because the probability of harm is going up. But historically, we have changed the equation. So by now having cars that it's kind of hard to kill us, right? Like all these panels, the side panels, the front panel, the rolls, the roll bars, the airbags, I mean, you can get in a head-on collision at 65 miles an hour and walk away almost unscathed. And so consequently, people are driving erratically. We're driving crazier than ever because now we've got this homeostasis of we really didn't change the level of tolerance. You know, we're still willing to take certain risks, but because now you've made roads and cars so safe, we can drive like maniacs and maintain that same risk tolerance. Well, think about all of the various sports and helmets that we're having, and the water sports and the climbing sports, as we're getting really, really good technology, including your phones that you think that you, when you push a button, somebody's going to be there immediately, right? Because you think that this technology has changed the equation some people are starting to take greater risks as a result.
Yeah, and for listeners who didn't hear it, Deb and Luke were on a Hometown Alaska in this past June of 2024. It's a great show, listen to, you guys get into technology a bit. So homeostasis, though, we're sort of talking about the benefits and cost. So we set, my understanding, Deb, is we have a certain level of risk we're willing to take, and then we have a perception of the particular moment of like what we're in, and that's our homeostasis is a balance, you know, and that's what we're looking at. We're trying to balance what our level of risk tolerance is versus what the situation is. Do I have that pretty
correct?
Much right?
And so I'll get into a little bit more, but just always keep in mind, some of it's going to happen automatically, right? So like if you haven't slept well, if you haven't eaten well, if you're getting in a fight with your spouse, these are all things that are actually inside of you. You will probably have stress chemicals in your system, right? Now you hear the roar of the water because you're going to do a class 3 or class 4 rapids. You're going to have some chemicals in the system. Whether or not you even think about it, you will have stress chemicals in the system. And so it's kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. The more stressors you add, and a few stressors, and it actually is kind of fun, right? But when you reach too many stressors, like now it's like, okay, you're going to be in class 4, but you're going to be solo paddling and you haven't been doing so well. Now the stressors just got to be too much. It is no longer fun for me. So instead of just a nice adrenaline rush, I'm actually stressed out here. And so the benefit of this, of making this rapid, is not outweighing the probability of something going wrong. So we all are going to have certain risk tolerances. It's going to change on the day. It's going to change with our age. It's going to change with whether or not we have children. It's going to change according to our capabilities. Like, so for me, you two are both water people. I'm not really a water person. So class 3 water is going to be way more stressful to me than it is to the two of you. I like land better, but I don't mind remote. I don't mind bears. So that doesn't really stress me out because I'm very familiar with that. We tend to be usually less stressed the more familiar we are with things.
I kind of want to introduce a few more terms that just, again, with that goal of people being able to talk about this within their groups. And one term that we haven't explicitly defined is hazard. Basically, the thing that can cause harm. And for all of the environmental hazards, these are things that we have no control over. And I appreciate that. It's really easy. It's actually easier, I think, to identify these things, such as a lightning strike or a flash flood. But on a smaller scale, like a downed tree that's across the trail and you're out for a bike ride, a rapid, a rock in the river, a snow slope. So environmental things that we have no control over. Much harder, at least for me to wrap my head around, are the human subjective hazards. And those I think we probably do have some control over. But it's helpful for me to sort of, when I go to a trailhead and we talk about the day's plan, just to identify like what hazards specifically are we likely to encounter. And I think that's pretty easy to identify even without a bunch of experience.
That was outdoor safety instructors Debbie Yongo and Luke Mell talking to Paul Twardock in an episode of Outdoor Explorer from October 2024. That's all for this week's show. Thanks to our host this week, Paul Twardock, his guests who joined him to talk about developing huts and cabins, Arctic Valley Ski Area General Manager John Robinson Wilson and architect Alana Blau, and Alaska Huts Association's Executive Director Philip Sweeney. Outdoor Explorer is produced by me, Tobin Shelby, with assistance from Ammon Swenson. Thanks again for joining us, and from everyone here at Outdoor Explorer, we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS 88.1 FM in Falls Pass and KKQA 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
You are listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.